Hello, everybody. Has everybody learned to bring their sweaters and their scarves here? You forgot. I've got one in my chair. Yeah, on my chair at my desk. First come, first serve. She's like, I'm going right now. So, welcome. Class of 2016, right? You guys are the graduates. But I'm guessing some of you are new. I've heard Temple and his wife, Brenda, they're new, right? So I always just love to see who shows up for Tantra. It's just always kind of funny. It's brave and beautiful. So who's new? Brand new. You're brand new?
Not brand new, but I haven't been.
Okay, but you're new to the modules.
Yes.
So brave souls. Who else is new? Are you new? You're new? Hey. So this is going to be fun tonight. You have Don Brown. He's coming back to teach Tantra. He's the only brave soul to teach it, so he's the one. And I'm Jill, the center manager, so I just pop into the first class of every module to just say hello, introduce myself, and welcome, and make sure Joanna's not dropping everything. So she's going to give you all the ins and outs of the building and the class, so I'm just here to say hello and do a little plug. Everything we do here, you probably already know, and most of you have heard me say this many times, Steve's nodding, that we do everything by donation. So if you don't know this, it's actually kind of shocking that in the whole world we are one of the few centers that offer everything by donation only. And to see how far we've gotten with everything by doing that is just beautiful. And yesterday we started celebrating our 25th anniversary. So we're going to do it for a whole year, and you're the beneficiaries of all the party food outside. Eat it up, because it's all left over. So we like to remind you that if there's any way you'd like to donate, there's boxes outside of the door and outside of this door and on my desk. You can donate online. You can whatever you need to do, any way that you feel moved. So I did want to also mention that yesterday Don read a letter from Lama Yeshe, which was the very beginning of, I want to teach something with, like, how many, three people, four people? You know, when he asked, how many people were going when he asked Lama Yeshe about that? Dozen?
Yeah, maybe a dozen.
Okay, so maybe a dozen. So he wrote to him in India at the time? Tibet? In Kopan, probably. And just asked him advice about teaching. And he wrote a very beautiful letter. There's a display outside this door if you'd like to read it. But the reason I used that for this display was the word encouragement stuck out in my mind. So you guys, most of you, are finishing 2 years of studying Buddhism, and you're graduating, and you've been here, you've stuck through it, and I know how I felt when I finished it. And I just want to say that when you're finished, you're not finished. You are not finished by any means. You're stepping into a beautiful new world. We just want to make sure that you understand that we are all here for you. We want to encourage you, because your practice is just going to start blossoming. You now have the knowledge. What you choose to do with it is your own. But it's to just check in with students that have been here a while. Ask them questions. You can start to feel it happening. So I just want to encourage you to start saying, we hear things like water bowls, like what, you know, glass, metal, big, small, statue, what? And so all these beautiful questions start to come out. So I just wanted to encourage you today to be encouraged by your tenaciousness, making it through. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. And to ask, not just the teachers, they're here for you, but also ask some of the students and share and get together. Go out for coffee. Enjoy each other. So that's what I'm here to tell you to do. Go drink more coffee.
So good evening. I'm Joanna Smith, and most of you know that I'm the person who sort of assists with these classes, helps out the teachers. They do all the teaching. And Don, we have two folks here who are here at Kadampa for the very first time, Temple and Brenda. And then we have two other folks who are at Discovering Buddhism for the first time. Is that right? And yeah, okay. And everybody else are old hands. More or less. Okay. Well, if you did not get a handout, they're on the table right back there. Please be sure and grab one. I'm going to read through it with you quickly. We're going to have six sessions. This is the last class, the last module of classes in the Discovering Buddhism series. And the cycle will start again in September of this year. We'll start all over again with Robbie, right? Are you be teaching? Mind and... Yeah, yeah. Oh, I want you to, please. Okay. So that will start in September. So those of you who want to cycle through again or pick up classes you missed, the opportunity will be there. Our last class is going to be on July 25th, and it's going to include practice day, and we'll talk about it. It's going to start early, around 6:30, and we're going to have a party at the end to celebrate graduation. We're going to have a graduation party. Yeah. Yeah. So make sure you come to the last class. And if you miss a class, you can make it up by watching the streaming online on our Kadampa website or listening to the audio. In order to access those audio and streaming, you need to be able to get to the member area on our website. So you need to be a member. And we have new member orientation every second Sunday of every month from 12 to 1 right after the teaching. So if you'd like to join, you can do it then. The videos are also on YouTube, but they don't stay up there very long. But you might be able to find what you're looking for there if you don't have access to our member area of our website. So the second page of your handout is our instructions on how to access the FPMT Online Learning Center, where a lot of the readings are. And it's very easy to set up a user ID and password, and you'll get access. And this enrollment key is the password you'll need to access the Tantra module. Also on the online learning center are readings that you can download as a PDF. And the texts that we'll be using this module are Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand, which we use for every module, Introduction to Tantra, which is available in our bookstore, and A Short Practice of Forearm Chenrezig. And those of you who did the Bodhicitta module may have bought that practice book then. So we have a few copies of that, but we have lots of copies of Introduction to Tantra. And as usual, we encourage you to use the class completion cards and to do the meditations and the readings, because that's where the learning really happens. Don presents loads of material here, but going back over it and reading it and meditating on it is where you're going to learn it. If you would like to get a... If you're going filling out the completion card, be sure and have Don sign it, the last module. And if you get all 14 modules signed or completed, you can then submit them to FPMT for a Discovering Buddhism completion certificate. Okay, I think that's all I have to say.
So I have come to most of these. Mm-hmm. There's a couple modules that I missed, and mm-hmm. some of them I did streaming because I've been so busy. Do the passwords stay the same, or do they change, you know, like deity yoga?
As far as I know, they stay the same. I'm sure we'll be, if they don't, we'll be known. We'll find out.
Okay, because I need to go back in some cases and pick up some of this stuff.
Okay, well, why don't you and I talk afterwards? Okay. Any other questions, comments? Okay, thank you.
So, welcome to Discovering Buddhism. So the introduction to Tantra. This is, I shake my head when I think about this class. Because it's too much, almost. It's so much material. So I decided this time we're going to cut to the chase and, you know, really try to make it... I want people to understand why, you know, what Tantra is about. As no doubt you will if you come every time. You know, this is a nice... kind of gentle introduction to it. There's so much to know, and Tantra is kind of the unique thing in Tibetan Buddhism. I mean, look around you. Oh my gosh, all of this. I even wore my Madras shirt tonight just as a spirit of Tantra, because everything about in Tibetan Buddhism is in technicolor. You know, you go to, anybody ever been to a Zen temple? You know. Yeah, it's black, it's dark. I mean, I'm not saying that's bad. I love Zen temples, but been to Japan and all that kind of stuff. But there's not a lot there to excite the senses. But you come to a Tibetan temple, it's like, oh, it's very much like this. And the whole point, you know, the colors all have symbolic meaning, that there's power in the color and it affects your mind a certain way. And I haven't done a double blind study on this. However, you know, green Tara, this green female Buddha deity, I mean, she's green. And when you visualize, if you... blah, blah, blah. If you do the practice and prepare yourself properly to practice Tantra, and you understand it properly and your motivations there, and to practice Tantra, you need to have taken refuge. You have to be sort of a card-carrying Buddhist, really. You have to have faith that this is your path. If you jump through all those hoops, then what you'll do is you will imagine yourself, all of your identity, your ordinary sense of self, every story you've ever made up about yourself, particularly the negative ones, all that stuff, just, we realize it's all made up. It's not the truth. We are not that. That's just story. We are, you know, there's no findable self that exists the way we feel we exist. So we allow that sense of self to really just to disappear, dissolve into the space of emptiness. And then from that space of emptiness, you will, male or female, doesn't matter. You can, in Tantra, you imagine yourself as both. You'll imagine motivated, again, this is so important, that your motivation for practice, if it's not right, you become, instead of, Luke Skywalker, you become Darth Vader. I'm not kidding. It's a big deal. Your motivation needs to be one of compassion. So you're motivated by this bodhicitta, compassion, the wish to become enlightened for all sentient beings. You know, then we can, and from this space of emptiness where we've allowed all of our ordinary notions of ourselves to disappear, we let go of it. From that space of emptiness, we imagine that, motivated by love and compassion and this great mind of bodhicitta, poof, we arise as this perfect being. Now, Tara. And you see yourself as a woman. If you're a man or a woman, if you're a woman, you see yourself as a woman. Your body's completely made of light. It is green, and there's something important that it's green. And if you do Medicine Buddha, you'll visualize yourself as like Lapis Lazuli over here, this blue deity. And if you visualize yourself as Vajrasattva, and that's a practice that we're going to do some, quite a bit of, I hope, you visualize yourself as white. So each one of these, and if you visualize yourself as a passionate being like Vajra Yogini, where you're working with the energy of passion, you visualize yourself as red. So each of these colors has power. And so everything in this Gampa is this one big tantric you know, it's full of tantric imagery. And yet, if you come on Sunday, Geshe-la won't tell you a thing about it. You have to come to this class almost to find out about it. Because it's, you know, it is considered, I mean, you can, when you see some of the imagery, and some of it is of male and female deities and union, and some of it, you know, so it has that sexual imagery, that part of it, you go, what's that got to do with spirituality? And it has, and it's not that, it's not, our ordinary mind goes there, but it's much more powerful, it's much, much more amazing than that. That's a mundane level. So Tantra has a, you know, there's a pedestrian understanding of Tantra that, you know, you can probably find it in the bookstore. But we're not going to, that's not really, that aspect of Tantra, that's also part of the Mahayana Vajrayana Tantra, but it's a very advanced level. And we're not going to talk much about it. We'll say a few words about it, but I really want to give people some sort of basic understanding so they can be slightly successful in doing this practice. So that's where we're going to go. Now, what business, you might be asking yourself, like, what business does Don Brown have teaching this class? And the answer is absolutely none. I need to get up and run out the door, but I'm not going to. I'm the only one that's ever taught this class, apparently, over the years. It's been long, I've been teaching many years, but it's tricky because, you know, theoretically you're not supposed to teach Tantra to people that aren't prepared. So, and then you read about it in the textbooks and they say, well, you know, it's sort of out there. You know, there are a lot of books people can read about it, and so we might as well just shine the light of day on it and try to give people as much useful information as we can in the context of as a Tibetan Buddhist spiritual practice. But again, it's not something that at this center anyway. Some centers maybe more so would emphasize tantric practice, but we don't. We emphasize, we might say tantra is the Vajrayana Tantra, lots of words, Mantrayana, Vajrayana, Tantrayana, different language, the way we language it. And these are the esoteric teachings of Buddhism, and sometimes we call it the resultant path. Kind of interesting way to talk, isn't it? And maybe in the audio they'll talk about it, the video too. But basically, you know, ordinarily, what's holding us back in the world? You know, what's keeping us from being extraordinary people? Our mind, yeah. And what aspect of our mind do you think is what's the mind saying that's holding us back?
You're not. It's above you. This is what you have. Can't do anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have so many self-limiting concepts. You know, we have a spiritual inferiority complex. And yet here, in Vajrayana, what we're doing is we're allowing, again, through correct understanding of the three principles of the path, which we'll go over in just a minute, bodhicitta, what's called renunciation, bodhicitta and emptiness. Through those, I found that sort of basic foundation, you know, and then, but really importantly, understanding emptiness and the fact that there is no I or self that exists the way we think we do, and that the way we think we do is loaded with stories that are limiting and holding us back. And if we can let that go, if we can dissolve that through wisdom, seeing that it's not true. So it's not like it dissolves, but it just disappears because it's not true. We can let go of that limiting views, and then imagine that we are a Buddha now. So they call it, you know, we call it the resultant path, because we're imagining through, again, a series of contemplations and understandings, we're imagining that we already have accomplished Buddhahood now. And then we practice, like, well, what would it be like to be a Buddha now? And we start practicing, like, I'd be kinder to people, and so we imagine ourselves being more compassionate and kind and wise and powerful and all the qualities of a Buddha. We imagine we're that now. And we'll do mantras and, you know, to sort of, you know, that have something to do with the energy of a particular deity that we want to practice, whether we want to develop wisdom or compassion, like Tara, she's compassionate action. She's ready to go to do whatever's necessary, or to purify or to heal. So all these different, there's so many deities within the pantheon of Mahayana Buddhism. So many Buddha figures that we can work with to cultivate whatever we need. Because we all have different limitations, different propensities, different limitations. So, you know, one practice would be perfect for one person, but wouldn't be the best practice for the next person. So again, I'm jumping all over the place, but who helps us decide what practice is the best one for us? It's the teacher, it's the guru. So here, in all of the texts that we read here at the center, you know, the foundation of all good qualities, which is a really wonderful text that I like to read at the beginning of classes. The very first stanza is about the importance of the guru, the importance of the spiritual master. And a lot of people that teach Lam Rim say, well, we shouldn't be talking about that now. I mean, that's sort of, it's too soon. And they're actually right in a sense, because that teaching on the importance of the spiritual master really comes down to Tantra. That's what it's really talking about. That's where, up until then, our teachers can be like our spiritual guides, our friends, we don't have to see them as a Buddha. You know, we don't have to see them as a perfect being. We're not encouraged to see them in any special way. But in Vajrayana, when we get to that level, thank you, Joanna, it's important. You know, it's important to be very careful who you choose as a teacher, somebody who's qualified and you know, is experienced, and we absolutely trust them, and they know our mind, and they can say, yeah, this would be a good practice for you, because I know that you need this kind of energy. You need this kind of practice, or, you know, like that. So the teacher becomes very, very important, and there are lots of examples of teachers who are not qualified and things not going well, and teachers who are qualified, things going, you know, like amazingly well. So it really is a big deal. I'm not a Vajrayana. I'm not a tantric teacher. I'm a cheerleader. I'm here to give you some information. But a real tantric master like Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who's coming in a couple of months, I mean, he's the real deal. People like the Dalai Lama, people that have done these long retreats and have really worked to transform their mind to become literally like a deity now, and to see their whole world as transformed. And we'll talk about what does the world look like If you were a Buddha now, how would that change your world? How would it change the way you see yourself, of course, the way we see each other? It would have a huge impact. But again, these are some things that we'll get around to eventually. There's a lot to talk about. But I would like to ask people to turn to one or two other people. And you must have had some reason to come here. I mean, not everybody shows up on Monday nights. There's other things to do. So I'd like for you to, and also to introduce, let at least one or two other people know who you are, break the ice kind of thing. So if you'd introduce yourself and one or two things that you would like to take home from this 6-week class, which I'm assuming everybody will be here every time, one or two things that you want to take out of here that you can actually, you know, that'll make a difference in your life. You know, not just information, but things that are real. So, got a couple of minutes to do this. Thank you.
How long is the bubble?
So let everyone talk. As always, let everyone have a word or two. And then bring those conversations to a close, please. Just to clear up any misunderstandings I might have left out there. I mentioned that Tantra is a resultant path where we take the future result, which is our enlightenment, and this is done, again, with great wisdom. We imagine, we bring that future result into the present and imagine that we're living out of that. We're identifying as a fully enlightened being, and there are no limitations to what we can do in the positive sense. That's called the resultant vehicle. The causal vehicle is basically the sutra vehicle in Tibetan Buddhism, and that's 99.999% of what gets taught here is we teach Lam Rim. Right, the graduated path to enlightenment, and we'll talk, because this is so important, and I don't want to, you know, I kind of joke about this, but they say the people who teach Tantra to people who are not prepared for it, you know, who don't have an intellectual understanding of the three principles of the path, at least, that the people that teach that to those people are all going to hell. Which means I'm in deep trouble. But I've been teaching this class a long time, so I figured that's why nobody else would teach it, because I'm a lost cause, you know. But, yeah, really, I'm in deep trouble already, so. But I do think it's important to have some basic understanding of the three principles of the path, at least at an intellectual level. So we may come back and visit that again and again. We will. And then, you know, Tantra, you know, one of the, you know, kind of some of the cooler things about it that we don't really talk about in the Lam Rim and the causal vehicle is that we're utilizing the subtlest level of mind. So we don't have the techniques in the sutra path to get to that subtlest level of mind. But in Tantra there are skillful ways to get there, and subtle is equated with powerful. Okay, so if we're meditating on reality and we're using like a laser, like a really powerful, subtle level of mind to contemplate reality, we can make much more progress, make much stronger impressions on the mind stream, and make spiritual progress much more quickly. So, in that, you know, Tantra is often And it's a good, you know, it's a good sort of way to advertise it, the quick path. You know, everybody wants, I won't tell my story, but anyway, once upon a time I asked the Dalai Lama, you know, what's the quickest way to get enlightened? And I won't go into what he said. But it's Tantra. But it has to be done, you know, by someone who's ripe, someone who's prepared their mind. It's like you don't go out and throw seeds on the parking lot out here. Nothing's going to happen. You know, you prepare the ground. You know, you till the soil, you put the fertilizer, you know, you work in the everything, and then you can plant the seeds and you'll get some results. So Tantra is the speediest path to gaining spiritual realizations. And the proof we have is that, you know, we have these, you know, people like the Dalai Lama are, you know, examples of these tantric masters who have been doing these practices, you know, for their entire lives, basically. Geshe Gelug is a tantric practitioner. Lama Zopa is a tantric practitioner. You know, they do these practices every day, you know. You know, you see a lot of people walking around with these things, much, much bigger ones than mine. You know, rosaries and saying mantras and so forth, all to stay connected to this awareness of themselves as a Buddha now. As a Buddha now. 24/7, 7 days a week, transforming, turning everything into the action of an enlightened being. Everything becomes sacred. Everything becomes like magical. And it's way different than the way we ordinarily approach our lives. But this is the way a Buddha would approach every experience in life becomes something that can be transformed into the path, into helping us become enlightened. So Tantra uses a lot of methods, you know, such as visualization and accessing these subtlest levels of mind that we don't ordinarily discuss in the sutra path. So why don't we do, this is about 25, 30 minutes maybe, and then we'll have a little bit of time at the end to, discuss that. Those of you who are new, this is, we try to do these videos before every class, but they were done off-site by different Buddhist practitioners. He came here one time, long, many years ago. He was this great lama who had spent like 15 years in solitary retreat doing this particular tantric practice called Kala Chakra, which we just happened to have a statue of. This statue back here is Kala Chakra. Anyway. He did that practice for many years, and he's obviously, I think a tantric master in the true sense of the word. I'm not gonna answer a lot of questions right now from that video, because otherwise we wouldn't get any. We probably wouldn't get very far. There's a lot. I mean, he threw out so many different things to think about. I don't think it'd be helpful to go into it right now. I don't know how many people came yesterday, but that teaching that Lama Yeshe gave, in the very beginning. You know, do you remember who Lama Yeshe was, with the buck teeth and everything? he was sort of my teacher and the founder of the FPMT. Robbie met him. Anyway, this was 1980 when he gave those teachings. It actually became the basis for the book, Introduction to Tantra. But John Landau took lots of different teachings. But it wasn't long after that it was actually at that teaching that Lama Yeshe sent me this letter, and it basically, he was talking about teaching courses like this, and he said, I'm going to read it again because I think it's funny, but it's also true, I think. He said, "Congratulations for giving course. Should be divine pride." And we'll talk about divine pride in Tantra, in the attitude of Tantra. Is it, you don't see yourself, once you take a Tantric empowerment, you are now empowered to see yourself as a deity and to feel good about it. To feel good about yourself. To have what's called divine pride, not arrogance, but to really to connect with your Buddha nature. We all have some wisdom, some compassion, some kindness, some all of these positive qualities, and we have what's called Buddha nature. See, divine pride is really identifying with that. So he's telling me, he said, which I really don't ever think about very much, but he's telling me to do it. He says, "Should be divine pride and feel fortunate to give teachings for others, which American people so badly need." I like that part. He knew us pretty well. He knew the Westerners' minds. "Buddhist education offers American heart warm and blissful rather than empty, worthless life." Say that again. "Buddhist education offers American heart warm and blissful rather than empty, worthless life. Just giving encouragement, life worthwhile and enough." So he's getting me off the hook here a little bit. Just giving encouragement's enough. So that's what I'm doing. I'm just giving encouragement. But anyway, so let's talk a little bit, and then we don't have a lot of time tonight. So I want to talk briefly about renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness, because that's the door. And as John Landau was saying, now who's the newbies here tonight? Brand new? Okay. Have you studied Buddhism at all? Okay. How about you? Have you had much? Okay, good. A little bit. And no? So this is all new. Well, just hang in there. It is a little bit. Coming into this class is sort of like going into a calculus class at the, you know, the last night, right before the exam, when the teacher's reviewing the data, you know, because this is the calculus class in Tibetan Buddhism. But it also has some practical aspects. I mean, if we think about it, I used to think about this. Like, for example, a couple of years ago at our office, we had, we came up with a mission statement. You know, how many people have mission statements? You know? And the whole idea of the mission statement was, well, we're not those things now. You know, when we looked at the mission statement, those were things we aspired to be. And we tried, and we thought about it. We actually tried to create the mission statement sincerely. And it was like, okay, we're not living that day in and day out 24/7, but we want that now. We want to take that future result, the mission statement, and try to have that be how our office runs every day of the week. And I think there are a lot of examples of tantric mentality. You know, even if you talk about designing an architect who designs a building. I mean, there has to be a vision, right? some vision of what it's going to look like before you can actually create it. And then once you get a clear vision and you can come up with a blueprint, then you can actually quickly build that building. So the Tantra really is getting in our own mind's eye a vision of what our potentials are and sincerely having faith in that, that we can do that. Islam used to call it divine pride. Not ordinary pride, but some real taking stock of our potential, our Buddha potential, which most of us don't feel like we have any very much potential, do we? I mean, honestly, I mean, if I said, you could get enlightened, you go, well, maybe he can, but not me. We wouldn't think that way, would we? We don't think we can do it. We have such those beliefs, those ordinary beliefs, seeing ourselves as ordinary, and feeling ourselves as being limited beings, is what's holding us back from being extraordinary. And so Tantra has, you know, this whole notion of having a clear image of yourself as the deity, as, you know, great visualization of yourself as the deity, and having divine pride in the qualities of that being and believing in it in your heart of hearts, kind of coming from that perspective, really helps us grow tremendously in our spiritual practice. Otherwise, we hold ourselves back by our self-limiting beliefs. So it's not an easy thing to wrap our mind around, but it's crucial. So let me talk about that. So in the teaching, we got a lot of DB people here who, I mean, I know this is old hat, renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness, but I'm not going to ask you to define it tonight. But renunciation is a weird term, and I'll read a few words here from the text. Lama Yeshe calls it emerging, renunciation, or definite emergence. The definite decision to leave behind the round of suffering and its causes, the delusions rooted in ignorance. It is futile to practice Tantra with the aim of attaining enlightenment if we have not completely turned our back on samsaric suffering and the cause of that suffering. Furthermore, the practice of tantric meditation can lead to attainments of various extraordinary abilities or powers, as well as the experience of bliss. If we've not developed renunciation, it is possible to become attached to these powers and blissful experiences, and such attachment can be a great hindrance to our spiritual development. So, when we talk about renunciation, I had a conversation with a friend recently, and I thought it really touched home, because I think it is so important. It's like this, renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness. If we have an intellectual understanding of these three aspects, then we are basically considered to be, you know, suitable vessels to practice Tantra, at least at the very beginning level. So, again, it's not enough to hear these words, but to actually have some feeling for the words, then we can practice Tantra. And if we can practice Tantra, it's kind of interesting that really accelerates the development of realizations of the three principles of the path. For a couple friends of mine, Roger and Paula Monroe, they were married at the time, but they did a 4-year silent retreat, no touching or anything, and they lived in the same area. When the retreat was over, I asked him, I said, well, what did you, you know, what was like the big take home of 4 years of tantric retreat? And they said, they said the bodhicitta, the three principles of the path. This is what they really got, a very profound experience of renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness. And John Landau is saying he did this Vajrasattva retreat, which is usually a 3-month retreat, and that's what he got. So I think what I'm trying to say is that when we practice, and really when we understand, when we really do some sincere meditation practice, we can begin to see what a mess our mind is. And I don't mean to be sounding negative here, but I have had that experience myself. It's like we have, you know, we think we have control, but we have no control over what's going to arise in the mind in the next moment. You know, we can choose to get up and walk out of the room. Yeah, we have some control. But when we sit down and meditate and you try to follow your breath for 5 minutes, stuff comes up. I mean, and there's really no sense of control. And you do a practice like John did for 3 months, where you really, the practice is designed to bring things up. And you realize there's really, our mind is a mess. And stuff comes up all the time, and it's memories of things that we've done that we regret. A lot of it is stuff that we are sad about, stuff that we want to let go. But sometimes it's bliss, too. They're pleasant experiences. But we realize anything can come up at any time. We have no control. The only thing we have any control over is how we react to it. That's the power. Like, if anger arises in the mind, or fear, or strong, you know, sensual desire, or jealousy, or just whatever you can imagine that would disturb your peace of mind, when these states of mind arise, ordinarily we're swept away by them, aren't we? You know, we just are hooked by these mind states and don't have anything to say about it. But what we can train ourselves to do is to notice the anger, the fear, the jealousy, the attachment, the pride, and all these disturbing mind states. We can train ourselves to catch them early and not get hooked and let them go and just let them pass through without disturbing our peace of mind. And this is not easy. But again, we don't have, my experience, and I think this is what I'm hearing John say, is, you know, renunciation is really, is this acknowledgement that we're in a heap of trouble. There's problems ahead. There, you know, we all have to deal with sickness, old age, and death, and nothing lasts. Everything that we cherish and love is going to go away. Nothing is going to last, including this one. It's not going to last. And so we're caught in this whole process of uncontrolled causation. How can we, you know, I don't like it. I don't like it being out of control. I don't like being unhappy. I want to be free of suffering. You know, I can't get away from sickness, old age, and death. That's going to happen to everybody, isn't it? But suffering, we don't have to suffer because we're sick, because we're getting older, or because we're dying. There are people that don't suffer or suffer less because they have control over their mind. That when they deal with life's, whatever life presents to them. So this whole notion of renunciation is this coming to terms with what it means to be a human being, and particularly you, what it means to be you and the state of your mind. And is your mind a mess? And you probably, you know, unless you've taken a look at it, you wouldn't really think it was. But most people who've done any meditation for any period of time usually have their initial experience is, my mind's such a mess because we have such little control over it. But gradually through stages and preparing ourselves and developing the qualities and the strength of mind, we can rein in this wild elephant of our mind and train it and subdue it and find peace and be able to let go of these disturbing states of mind. But renunciation is coming to terms with the fact that we are caught in a process of uncontrolled causation. And there's no, we are, and it's a mess. It's going to get worse unless we take some definite steps to be free. And that's the big part of it. In Buddhism, it's the renunciation is the determination to be free. Free of what? Free of suffering. We can't be free of problems. We can't be free of sickness, old age, and death, and all that goes along with just being a human being. But we don't have to suffer. We can be free of suffering. So that's kind of a wild statement, because nobody ever told you before you, I would guess, you don't hear that in Christianity. I didn't hear it at the First Presbyterian Church in Greenville, where I used to hang out. Yeah, you know, the idea that we could actually be free of suffering is what the Buddha is telling us, and what renunciation is pointing to, that we're renouncing suffering. The understanding is we can be free. It's possible to be free, and that's pretty wild. And sometimes you hear even people talk about it as like having. Once we've looked at our mind, we've done some practice, we understand that, yeah, our mind is kind of a mess, and, you know, we don't have a lot of self-control, and compassion arises sometimes, but it's not my ordinary day-to-day experience, loving kindness and compassion, forgiveness, and all those things that we would consider to be positive mind states. You know, we have to understand that it's possible to actually have that be the case. We have to have some faith. And again, this is where faith comes in Buddhism. We have to have some faith that the Buddha was telling the truth when he said, you could be free of suffering. You could be free of suffering. And really, it's at some level, it's about having some compassion for yourself. It's like you come to terms with what a mess our mind is, and how many problems we're going to have to deal with, and how we're not going to do well, usually. And having some compassion for ourselves, that, golly, I need to take care of me. I need to get myself together. I need to live ethically. I need to practice. I need to develop these meditation. I need to develop my mind in terms of realizing these particular meditations so that I can be prepared for the future. So, again, renunciation. This Lama's calling it emerging, but it's this emerging from suffering, this determination to be free. But until we got it that we're sick, we have no determination to be free, do we? You know, if you're sick, if you wake up in the morning and you have 105 fever, but you don't think there's a problem, you won't go to the doctor, will you? You know, or you wake up in the morning and you vomit up blood and you go, well, there's nothing wrong. You know, you won't actually go try to figure out how to fix it. So it really is, coming to terms with our own reality and then having some determination to be free. And I think it has everything to do with having compassion for ourselves. You know, it has compassion for you, that you're going to do whatever it takes to develop, to eliminate your faults and develop your positive qualities. That's really the heart of renunciation. And so just right now, whatever you get from what I've said, if you have any sense of it, that's really a good enough for me to go on to the next step. And that's called bodhicitta. And we just
I think I did teach the class on bodhicitta a few months ago. And this is another concept in Buddhism where it's not the natural way we think. Ordinarily, we're driven by what? What drives us mostly?
Selfish.
Yeah, our ego. Our self, you know, we're, I have, you know, I go to this place where I'm too lazy to exercise without a trainer. I have to confess to this. So anyway, so this guy William, who's been training me for a while, he says on the back of his shirt, he says, "Who trains you?" And you know, I think my ego trains me. You know, that's what we live our lives based on, our ego's preferences. Our ego tells us to go here, to do that. You know, somebody affronts me, I get angry, I see something attractive or delicious, I have to possess it, and so on. So ordinarily our ego is, we'll talk about it, is our ego is our biggest problem. And I'm not talking about a healthy sense of ego, I'm talking about a distorted sense of self. And so so bodhicitta is antithetical to that, because it's like it comes from genuine love and compassion for all living beings, not just your loved ones and close ones, but all living beings. So you go, well, how can I hate Hitler or Saddam Hussein or, you know, whoever the bad guy of the day is, you know, ISIS? How can I hate? How can I love these people? How can I have any compassion for people like that? You know, but bodhicitta really is, doesn't exclude anyone. The notion of bodhicitta is like, I must develop myself as much as I possibly can. I must develop all of the positive qualities that I already have. A little compassion, I want to grow it infinitely. I already have a little wisdom, I want to grow it. I have some kindness and generosity and forgiveness, I want to grow it infinitely. I want to grow the positive qualities as much as I can, and I want to eliminate my negative qualities. Okay? And I want to become a Buddha. Why do I want to become a Buddha? It's not just for me. It's because I want to help people. This is what, you know, Kritisintsa Rinpoche is saying. The Bodhisattva is somebody who has this belief, that has this faith, that the purpose of my life is to help others and to help them find solutions to their own problems. The purpose of my life is to liberate all beings from suffering. Now, of course, it hasn't been done yet, so it's not easy to do, but it's an attitude that these extraordinary beings called bodhisattvas have cultivated through training their mind over time. So they have this amazing mind of, I must help other beings. I must liberate all beings from suffering and guide them to supreme enlightenment. And it's my responsibility alone. And the only way I can do that is to get my act together, to develop myself. So this is bodhicitta. This is like understanding that, you know, having this intention to become enlightened, the altruistic intention to become enlightened for the sake of others. I must become enlightened to help others, you know, and the way to do that is to develop myself, you know, to develop the qualities and eliminate the faults. And this is why Tantra is so powerful, because it helps us grow in our Buddha nature, that Buddha potential that we have. It helps us grow it like wildfire. It helps us, it accelerates the growth of our Buddha potential. So, and now, it's a bodhicitta, again, is this, you know, there are two aspects of it. One is, you want to help others, and one is, you got to get enlightened to do that. And what examples do we have of it? I mean, sometimes I jokingly say, well, you know, I'd like to get up tomorrow morning and and you know, go do open heart surgery and save a bunch of people over there at Wake Med, kind of like Dr. Landvater does. You know, he's a great heart surgeon. I think I'll just go over there because I really want to do that. I think it's a great idea. I'm ready. Well, you know what? I'm not ready. I've got the intention. I want to help, you know, and I want to do heart surgery, but I haven't been trained. I haven't done the work. I haven't, you know, gone through the years and years of training to get myself in a place where I can actually make that kind of have that kind of impact on people who need you know, that kind of surgery. And from a spiritual perspective, you know, the people that can really have the greatest impact on others is someone who's developed themselves already, a Buddha. So again, bodhicitta, I must become a Buddha in order to help others. It's an attitude that we try to develop. It's not something that we can do, you know, quickly, but if we can even have, even if it sounds like a good idea, you know, well, I don't think I can do that, but I sure would like to be able to do that. That's a good start. That's really a good start. And that's kind of the second aspect, principal aspect. And then the third one, which, you know, we don't have a lot of time, but we're over time. But the third one is emptiness. And we've talked a little bit about it earlier. It's about seeing that this whole sense of who we believe ourselves to be, is this concrete sense of self or I. And we do exist. There's no doubt. There's a Don, there's a Robbie, there's a you, there's a Nate, you know, there are a lot of people in this room. And there are going to be people out there. We all exist. But our ordinary perception of how we exist is a distortion. And this is what the Buddha realized when he became enlightened. He saw that the way that he had been seeing himself was a misapprehension of the way he truly existed. He saw himself as being this sort of concrete, reified, I'm the most, you know, we feel like we're the center of the universe, don't we? We feel like we're so important. We have this really strong sense of self that if somebody affronts me, I get angry. And again, if I see something desirable, I have to have it. And the Buddha said, we do exist, but that self, that one that I just described, is a misperception. It's a misapprehension. It's the ultimate delusion. It's the ultimate mistake because it causes all the problems. It's the taproot to samsara. It's the taproot to all of your suffering, all of your stress, all of your anxiety, all of your depression, all your fear, all of your jealousy. Everything comes from one taproot, and it's this mistaken perception of who we are. And the Buddha said, when we can let go of that, when we can see it as an illusion and let go of it, we can see that it's false, you know, then we're free. Then we're free. And so that's the third aspect of the three principal aspects. And we'll talk a lot more about these later on. But we have to wrap things up tonight. Joanna, how many do we have of the... So I want to give people some homework to do. And this is a tantric practice that is going to be, if you do it, it's in this little book. And if you have a copy of it, then don't take another one, please, because they're only a limited number. They're free. But I want you to read through this. And there's a mantra. There's a long mantra. You don't have to do the long mantra, if you cannot memorize it. If you can memorize the 100-syllable mantra, then more power to you. It's a great mantra to memorize. But just try to read it. Read it through, and we'll go over this next time. We'll definitely do this practice next time. But this is a purification practice. This is the one that John Landau said he did for 3 months in India, where he really got what the meaning of Tantra was, and he really understood how to write this book and what Lama Yeshe meant. So this is a text where it's very ritualized. So you just kind of creatively align with it to the degree you can, but it's a powerful ritual. You'll read through it, and then you'll visualize above your head Vajrasattva. And in this case, it's going to be Vajrasattva, you know, with consort. But, you know, if you're uncomfortable with that, don't worry about it. Usually the best any of us can do anyway is a white light. So that's good enough. You don't have to, you know, if you can visualize that kind of detail, amazing. But a white light's good enough. And then you'll visualize different colored lights and nectars entering you, purifying, as you do the mantra, purifying your body. And then you'll maybe do seven mantras purifying your body of all your negative karma of body. And, you know, and we've done, you know, and you can think about stuff in this life that you've done. The three that we typically talk about are killing and stealing and adultery. But you say, well, I've never done any of that in this life, but you've done it in past lives. So, you know, just go with it. We've done it all many times over. So, you know, just try to think, okay, I'm purifying all that negative karma of body, and then speech is usually lying, slander, harsh and frivolous speech. We've all done all of that countless times in this life and in former lifetimes. So you do seven more mantras, visualizing the light and nectar entering your body, and there's a specific visualization. But you'll do that seven times, and as you do it, you'll think, okay, I'm purifying my speech. And then you purify your mind of delusions like greed, hatred, ignorance, pride, jealousy, fear, anything you can come to, anything you can bring to mind. And if you can bring specific instances in your life, like if you killed an animal or a human being or whatever, you know, if you've done something that really, you know, we've all done stuff. And if we didn't do it in this life, you did it in a past life. So just be open to that possibility, and then allow, you know, the light and nectar to purify the negative karma of killing and stealing and adultery and all the things that we talked about. So you'll do seven mantras while you do purify your body, seven of speech and seven of mind. And by the way, if you see where they call it a short Vajrasattva practice, if you can't remember, if you don't want to do the 100-syllable mantra because it's just too much, you can just say Om Vajrasattva Hum. Got that? Real easy. Om Vajrasattva Hum. And then you can just keep saying that over and over again as you do the visualization. But this is a nice kind of general entry into Vajrayana. So I hope this, you know, for our new people here tonight, you know, thank you for coming. And if you come back next week, great. But this is just a taste of where Buddhism can take people who are ready for this this level of practice. And we'll start back next week and try to do this practice once a day. I'm going to do it at least once a day. The best time to do it is at night before you go to bed, to kind of clear your mind. You'll sleep better. I promise you, you'll sleep better if you do it. So last thing we do, we didn't do it before, but we'll just mentally dedicate all the positive potential. So we created some positive energy here tonight, individually and collectively. We want to dedicate that positive energy not only to our own happiness, but to the happiness of all living beings. So thank you. Thank you for your attention, and I look forward to next week.
Thank you, Don. Yeah. I know we've run over tonight, but if you could stay a few minutes to help us rearrange the room back where it was originally, it'd be greatly appreciated. Thank you. See you next week.